This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest Ryan Gosling was nominated for a Golden Globe yesterday in the category Best Actor Drama for his performance in the new movie Blue Valentine. His co-star Michelle Williams was nominated for Best Actress. Gosling earned a Best Actor Oscar nomination playing a drug-addicted inner-city teacher in the film Half Nelson, and he got a Golden Globe nomination for Lars and the Real Girl, where he was an introvert in love with a life-size sex doll. He was the romantic lead in the film The Notebook, and he's currently starring with Kirsten Dunst in All Good Things, inspired by a story of disappearance and murder in a wealthy New York family. His new film Blue Valentine, directed by Derek Cianfrance, is an emotionally intense drama that follows a young married couple as they fall deeply in love and as their relationship falls apart. Here's a scene with Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams in which the distance between them is growing.
Why don't you do something?
What does that mean? Why
don't I
do
know.
Something?
I mean, isn't there something you wanted to do? Is there something you want to do?
Like when?
I don't know. If you're so good at so many things, you could do anything you wanted to do. You're good at everything that you do. Isn't there something else you want to do?
Then what? Then be your husband? Then being Frankie's dad? What do you want me to do? What in your, like, dream scenario of me, like, doing what I'm good at, what would that be?
I don't know. I just mean you're so good at so many things. You can do so many things. You have such capacity.
For what?
I don't. You can sing. You can draw. You can... dance.
Listen, I didn't want to be somebody's husband, okay? And I didn't want to be somebody's dad. That wasn't my goal in life. Some guys it is. It wasn't mine. But somehow, it was what I wanted. I didn't know that. And that's all I want to do. I don't want to do anything else. That's what I want to do. I work so I can do that.
I'd like to see you have a job where you don't have to start drinking at 8 o'clock in the morning to go to it.
No, I have a job that I can drink at 8 o'clock in the morning. What a luxury, you know? I get up from work, I have a beer, I go to work, I paint somebody's house, they're excited about it, I come home, I get to be with you. What's, like, this is the dream.
A scene from the new film Blue Valentine. Ryan Gosling spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Ryan Gosling, welcome to Fresh Air. Your new film, Blue Valentine, is about you in a relationship with Michelle Williams, a relationship where, you know, love has eroded. I mean, you were once madly in love, and now you fight a lot, you're tense, you're impatient with each other. And I read that you shot the scenes of the early part of the relationship all at once, and then there was like a month or so break between then and when you shot the times when the relationship was on the rocks. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. So what happened? What did you do in the intervening month?
Well, we sort of lived in the house that our characters lived in. And what we were trying to do was dismantle this thing that we've been building because, you know, we all worked really hard to kind of create this. We focused on the love, the story portion, and the past when they're falling in love, and we wanted it to feel genuine and real and true, and we, you know, we spent all this time building it up, and then we had to tear it down, and tearing it down was difficult.
But you actually lived in a house with Michelle Williams and the child actor who played your daughter.
Yeah, I mean,
for a month. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and then we had you know, fake Christmas and put up Christmas trees and bake birthday cakes and bought birthday presents and went to Sears and took the family portraits, and you know, we just, you know, we had a budget, and we fought all day, and then we'd have to take Faith to the family fun park and try and pretend like we haven't been fighting, and you know, we did the Jane Fonda workout, and you know, whatever we could do to create real memories. So when it came time to shoot that part of the film, that we were drawing on real memories.
So are you spending this month, what, kind of learning not to love each other somehow?
We're trying to not be able to hide from each other. You know, it's the way that the director had a kind of a manifesto, which was that in the past, when we would shoot it on film, which is kind of a romantic quality to it.
The flashback part, when you're young and happy, you mean?
Yeah, and that it would be all one takes, no do-overs. Everything that happens, happens for the first time, and then it's over. And we would share the frame together. And so, you know, when you're working that way, you build a... It's easy to maintain a mystery in that because you never have to go back and revisit a moment. You know, you can hide behind these personas that you've created, which, you know, is a lot, you know, it's a lot like when you're first falling in love, I guess. And then when we were doing the latter part of the film, it was all shot on digital, which has kind of a clinical, almost like surveillance camera feeling. And we were locked off into singles. We were never sharing the frame, or for the most part, he was trying not to. And we would do takes 50 times, 75. You know, it just we shot one scene for 2 days in the shower, just all day. You know, so when you're doing 50 takes with somebody, there's nowhere to hide. I mean, you can't. It's very exposing.
And so, do you replicate the feelings that your character has for his wife? I mean, do you get annoyed, impatient, angry?
Yeah, because you know that's what Derek wanted. He would say, you know, he would give us a budget, and you know, we'd have to fight about that, or you know, try to focus on the small stuff. Like, I'll give you an example. I met some friends of mine, and they're married. They were married, and I asked them what their biggest problems with each other were, and she was convinced and was got very upset that he, when he washed the dishes, didn't squeeze out the sponge. And she thought that he was doing it. It was a passive-aggressive act on his part. And he was doing it to just despite her. And he was trying to say, why would I go through the effort of washing the dishes just to not squeeze out the sponge at the end? You know, it doesn't make sense. But you couldn't. Anyway, it ended up becoming this. It was a huge thing in their relationship, and they've since gotten divorced. And so, I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but I'm going to take a stab and say that it wasn't because of the sponge.
Right.
But you couldn't tell them that. And so we didn't try to pretend to know the bigger reasons. You know, we just tried to genuinely, you know, focus on those small things and try and feel like they're as important to our characters as they would be to them in real life.
You know, there was a scene I wanted to ask you about, and it's in one of the flashback parts of the film where you and Michelle's character are getting to know each other, and it's shot on a bridge. Is that the Brooklyn Bridge you're on a walkway, I think?
Yeah, that's right.
And I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but she has a secret that she doesn't want to tell you. You can sense something as up and really want her to reveal the secret to you. And when she doesn't, you start to climb this hurricane fence there next to the walkway. And it looks as if that might actually put you in danger of going over. Tell us about that. Was that scene improvised?
Yeah. The film, that's how the filmmaker works. You know, he tells you, okay, so he pulls Michelle aside and says, look, don't, whatever you do, I don't care what he does, don't tell him your secret, okay? And if you tell him the secret, you lose, you know, because he set every scene up like a boxing match. And the action was when the bell rang. And when it was over, he would say who won or lost, you know. So then he'd say to me, pull me aside and say, I don't care what you have to do, but you got to get her to tell you her secret, action. And so hours go by, and I'm asking in every way you can ask somebody to tell him your secret. And it's humiliating because you, the things that you'll do, you know, to try and get someone to tell you, and she's not, you know, she's winning every scene. She's winning every round. She won't tell me until the sun starts to go down. And on top of this, we're stealing this shot on the Brooklyn Bridge. We don't have a permit. We could be kicked off, and we're not coming back. So I have to get her to tell me, and I started climbing over the edge of the bridge, and it wasn't until I was on the other side and hanging onto this fence and staring down at the water that I realized that, I'd been brainwashed by the director, and Michelle Williams was trying to kill me.
And then she blurts out her secret.
She tells me the secret. Thank God.
Right, right. And afterwards, did you talk? Was she really afraid that you were going to hurt yourself, and that's what finally caused her to cough it out?
Yeah, I mean, I think Michelle said that she felt like she was watching a movie, you know, so that's why she let me go so far. And I felt like I was in one, and the producer was crying. And it was, you know, it was stupid. I don't think it's cool or anything. I think it was dumb. You know, I think the movie would be the same without it. But it seems to be the scene that people kind of single out as an example of what working this way can evoke in an actor.
A lot of the part of the movie where the marriage is troubled takes place in a hotel room in the Poconos. It's the Future Room. It's this sort of stylized room that they sell. And you must have been shooting these nonstop marital fights day after day. I mean, what was it like emotionally just to just go through that in such close quarters? Could you shake it off?
It's hard to remember what happened because we were so, you know, I remember one time I fell asleep. We fought so hard that I had to take a nap. I fell asleep on the couch and I woke up and the director was filming me sleeping and filming her cleaning up the house. And then I woke up and we went back at it again. So it was, the lines were very blurred, you know, and it was very hard to tell, to remember making it.
You've got an interesting background. I mean, you grew up in Canada, and I read that you were homeschooled at some point. What led to that? What was wrong with you in the school system there?
Well, I really think that if I – two things. I think fluorescent lighting. I really think that if they had turned the lights off and could have just had natural light in the room, it would have been more soothing. But something about it genuinely – made me uneasy and was distracting. And also I think if they had let me walk around, you know, I think I feel like in classrooms if they had a space in the back of the class where you know, kids that are kind of hyperactive or whatever you want to call it could just kind of pace while the class was going on, I feel like that would help a lot, because I just have to move, you know, in order to think. If I'm sitting still, I can't really think straight. And I had a lot of problems. I wasn't doing very well, and they were kept passing me, and I was really falling behind. And at a certain point, they were trying to put me in these special ed classes, you know, just to see how that would work. And I remember playing chess one time with this kid who was in special ed, who was eating his queen. And I was thinking... I know that, you know, I'm not doing that well, but
something's,
I don't know,
wrong with this picture, huh?
Yeah, something's. So I talked to my mother, and she was very upset, you know, that they were passing me. You know, she thought she'd rather them fail me, you know, than to pass me, because I had pretty low, you know, self-esteem. Didn't feel like I was very smart, and I was getting into a lot of trouble because of that. And you know, she took me out of school, and she sort of, you know, she let me move around while I was learning, and found, you know, sort of alternative ways for me to learn. You know, she found out that, you know, she's got big rolls of paper and laid them out in the basement, and I drew, or I made pictures of the things that if I was learning about history, I would draw the scenarios that I was learning about, or the people that she was telling me about, and I was able to remember them that way, you know.
And you became a performer at an early age. And I know that you tried out for the new Mickey Mouse Club and against all odds was selected. But I also read that a reference in stuff about you to a move you developed on stage at age 7. Is this true? Can you describe this for us?
Well, my uncle was an Elvis impersonator, and a really great Elvis impersonator, went by the name of Elvis Perry. And although he didn't look much like Elvis, he sounded just like him, and I was in his act. I was very little, you know, I was like 6 or something, and 7. And I was ahead of his security, you know. And so I come out, and I took it pretty seriously. But I would watch him kind of get ready backstage, you know.
You were 7 and you were ahead of his security?
Yeah, it was like a joke, but I didn't know it. Joke was on me. I really thought that I was head of security, and the way that they talked to me was that I was head of security, and so that's I took it very seriously. And I took it as seriously as he did. You know, I'd watch him put on this you know, a sequin suit, and you know, that music would start playing. Bum, 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 ba-na, dun, 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 dun. And he was becoming Elvis, you know. He was like a racehorse banging against the boards. And it didn't matter that he was performing it, you know, at a town hall. You know, it could have been Madison Square Garden. And you know, there was something about watching him kind of get into character that really made an impression on me. And also his, you know, in his performance, he was highly sort of, you know, sexual. You know, I saw these women just going crazy for him, women losing their minds, trying to jump up on stage, and like he was Elvis. So I took some notes, and I started, you know, performing, you know, in like whatever, you know, like local talent shows or something that my father would put on. And I started being just as, you know, sort of sexual, if not more so than he was. And I saw that I got a certain response. You know, I see if you see like a 7-year-old or a 6-year-old kid gyrating on the stage, you know, everyone thinks that's pretty funny. And so I was able to kind of milk that for way too long. And I would go up to secretaries and kind of try and grind on them. And for some reason, everybody thought that it was fine. I think it was because I was so young. If I'd been any older, it would have been weird. I think it's weird, but...
Now, is that what got you the successful audition on the new Mickey Mouse Club when you were, like, what, 12 or so?
Well, no, I ended up, you know, I did that for a little while. And then I realized that I wanted to be a dancer. So I joined a dance company, and I was sort of training to be a dancer, and all of the girls in my class were auditioning for this TV show. And I just went, you know, because I wanted to be around the girls, you know. And I got it. I got the part. So we moved to, my mother and I moved to Florida, and we lived in this trailer park, Yogi Bear Trailer Park in Kissimmee, Florida. We lived in Boo Boo, Harlem, and I worked at Disney World for 2 years.
So here you are, a kid, on this TV show, The New Mickey Mouse Club, which, by the way, included Justin Timberlake and Christina Aguilera, right, and Britney Spears.
Mm-hmm.
And you're a kid essentially living at or around Disney World.
Yeah.
Did you grow up thinking this was normal?
No, but it changed my life, you know. Disney World, the park, changed my life.
How?
More than the experience of making that show. Well, two reasons. One is that, you know, I was, you know, these kids were kind of prodigies, you know. You look at, not all of us, I mean, I certainly wasn't, but you would look at someone like Christina Aguilera, who's, a, you know, was like 11 years old and, you know, like 40 pounds and singing like Etta James. And, you know, you see someone who's realizing their destiny. I mean, this is where they're supposed to be and what they're supposed to be doing in this. And the same goes for a few of the other kids. And, you know, I realized that my destiny wasn't that. You know, I wasn't a prodigy. I could do, you know, I could make it and do enough to get by on the show, but it wasn't my calling. And so I was depressed by that, but I was also encouraged to go out and find out what that was. And as a result of not being as talented as the other kids in the areas that were needed for the show, I didn't work a lot, so I spent a lot of time in Disney World, just kind of riding the rides and walking around. And it's made a big impression on me. You know, I thought, I was very impressed by Walt Disney and just in the idea that you could have a dream and that you could realize it to the point where people could walk around within it, and the attention to detail. You know, even the butter has ears. They haven't missed anything. And it's fascinating. You know, I still go to Disney World. In Los Angeles, I go to Disneyland at least once every couple months, you know, because it still kind of resonates with me. You know, I wanted to be somebody who believed in their ideas that much.
And so making movies is something like that, creating another world.
I found that so far, you could, you know, it's like when I was 14 and I saw Blue Velvet, you know, I wasn't supposed to see it. And I watched all the movies in my local movie store, and the guy gave me, he said, okay, if you like movies, you're going to like this. And I didn't even know what it meant. I still don't know what Blue Velvet is about, but I knew that I wanted to be somebody like that, somebody that believed in their ideas enough to make something like that, to be okay with the fact that it didn't make sense, you know, but it made sense to them.
So I want to move forward in your career. You did television, you did some films, you did a well-regarded performance in a film called The Believer, where you played a sort of a confused Jewish young man who becomes a neo-Nazi. And then in 2004, you do The Notebook, which is in which you were a romantic lead, and it was a big commercial success, and you became a heartthrob and could have looked for another big studio project, could have molded your career around being a leading man, and instead you picked this project, Half Nelson. Do you want to describe your character, Dan Dunn, in this film?
Yeah, he was, he's a teacher in a school in Brooklyn, and he's like a drug addict, but he's always on the mend. You know, he's always. I thought that the film kind of captured that the monotony of addiction. You know, a lot of films cover the person that kind of, you know, is a babe in the woods and they discover drugs and they have this kind of rock and roll roller coaster, and then they crash hard, crash and burn, and the movie ends. You know, but this was just kind of. Just about the monotony of cleaning up and trying to go straight, and then, you know, thinking that you've gone long enough, and then delving back into it, and then and then trying to pull back together again, and just how monotonous that can become, that kind of the cycle, you know, it just right. keeps repeating itself.
Well, your character is when he's not doing drugs. I mean, he's a teacher in an eighth grade inner city school, and talks a lot about dialectics, the Hegelian, you know, notion of history being conflicts. And I thought we'd listen to a clip from the film. Your character, Dan Dunn, takes an interest in a young girl who he coaches in basketball, also in his history class, but is concerned as he gets to know her that she may be falling under the influence of a neighborhood drug dealer, a guy who the girl's brother had worked for. And so your character, Dan, goes to confront this drug dealer about his interest in this eighth grade student who he might want to, you know, bring into the drug dealing business. And your character goes to confront him. The character, the drug dealer here, is played by Anthony Mackie. Let's listen.
Can I talk to you?
What's up?
Okay, look. I hate to be this guy right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I need you to stay away from Dre.
Excuse me?
You heard me, okay? So just do me this solid, all right, man? Please.
Do you solid?
You know what I'm saying. You understand.
Oh,
me.
So this like stay away from the girl, she's too precious kind of
I'm not kidding.
Oh, I know.
So you understand?
Look, man. Dre is my family. She's my friend, man. All these cats, these are my friends. Now, would you like to be my friend, man?
What the is this? Romper room?
The romper room.
Are you listening to
Look,
me?
Why are you so angry, man?
Because you are not listening
Look,
to
right
me.
I'm right here, baby. Tell me what you're talking
I'm
about.
I'm telling you to do something good.
Oh.
Are you capable of that?
Oh. So now we're back to the point of what is white is right, right?
So this has nothing to do with
no,
that.
No, no, no. It's good for Dre to have somebody like you looking out for, Mr. Model A1 citizen.
I don't know. I don't know.
And that's our guest, Ryan Gosling and Anthony Mackie in the film Half Nelson. I love that at the end where you say, I don't know. It's sort of like this guy who thinks he's helping out this girl suddenly realizes that the drug dealer, who's actually a criminal, has his life more together than he is. And he doesn't know whether this makes right. any sense.
Yeah, they're great directors. They're great filmmakers and great writers. You know, they really wanted that scene to be, you know, like a teacher that had seen Dangerous Minds or that film with Edward James Olmos too many times. You know, like just put yourself in the situation and try and act like the characters you've seen in movies, you know, but you can't really back them up, and you're more flawed than the bad guys.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with actor Ryan Gosling. He stars in the new film Blue Valentine with Michelle Williams. I also wanted to talk about Lars and the Real Girl, the film you made with Craig Gillespie in 2007. This is pretty unique film. I mean, you play this young man who lives in a garage apartment, painfully shy. I guess you could say he's somewhere maybe on the autism spectrum, avoids a lot of human contact, doesn't like being touched, and ends up getting a full-sized sex doll and introducing it to his family as his girlfriend. Town kind of begins, for reasons that unfold as the film develops, kind of plays along in a way. You know, when you looked at this script, why didn't it seem ridiculous? How did you see this working? When you describe that to somebody, they say, "Are you kidding me? I'm not going to see that movie."
Yeah.
And it really works. I think it's a terrific movie.
I felt the same way. The whole time I was reading it, I thought, you know, this shouldn't be working, but it is. And you know, I'd like to take credit for that, but it was just a really well written script. Nancy Oliver is a very, very special writer, and it worked. It worked as a script, you know, potentially more than it was going to work as a film, because it's like if you look at a book like, you know, The Velveteen Rabbit or something, you know, you talk about this kid who loves this bunny so much that it becomes real, his love makes it real. You know, that's an easier thing to imagine than it is to visualize. I mean, to actually, you know, kind of try and shoot that, then you have to get into it. How do we make it real? Like CGI? Do we use a puppet? You know, and then it turns into something. Something else, you know. I think the idea of a guy, you know, in the script, she became real. You know, when you were reading it, she became, the more real she was to him, and the more the town treated her like she was a real person, the more real she became to you. But when you're watching it, it's a guy talking to a doll, and she never becomes real. You know,
right.
It's never going to happen. It's always going to be a guy talking to a doll, no matter how, you know, how much I believe it, it doesn't make her real.
Well, let's listen to a scene. This is a scene where your character, Lars, has just told his brother and sister-in-law he has a visitor, and it's his girlfriend, and she's from abroad, and she needs a wheelchair, and they're excited to hear this because they think he's actually met someone. And then they bring the friend Bianca in and discover that indeed she's a sex doll, although she's fully dressed. And they're not quite sure how to react, and they say, well, we're having dinner. And so the scene we're going to hear is where you're all sitting at dinner, and they've set a place for your friend, your doll, Bianca, and you're beginning to explain to your sister and brother-in-law, who are played by Emily Mortimer and Paul Schneider, and there are some moments in the scene where you actually whisper aside to Bianca, the doll. Let's listen.
So you're never going to believe this. Oh, it makes me mad. Bianca's from the tropics. She's Brazilian. We're half Brazilian, half Danish, that's right. And somebody stole her luggage.
Oh.
Yeah. And they stole her wheelchair.
That's terrible.
Yeah. Can you believe that, Gus?
Yeah, I can't believe it.
Right. Well, it makes me angry. Anyway, I wanted to ask you a favor. She doesn't mind, I promise. Karen, you don't mind lending Bianca some clothes to you? She doesn't have any. Do you?
I'm not sure we're the same type, Lars.
Well, that's okay, Karen, because Bianca doesn't really care about superficial things like that, so it's okay. See, I told you. Thanks.
And that's our guest, Ryan Gosling, with his friend Bianca, the sex doll, in the film Lars and the Real Girl. How do you get this? How do you, you know,
she's
get
still
this
in my
right?
living room. By the she's still in my living room. By the way, She is. She's reading a book by the window. I don't know what to do.
I don't know whether you're kidding me or not.
I'm not kidding.
Really?
I'm not kidding. But what do I do? Put her in the garage? It just feels weird. It feels like she'll be lonely out there or something.
Do you ever talk to her?
No, I don't.
That's reassuring. Now, I read that, I don't know if this is true, I read that when the film was being made that the sex doll Bianca had her own dressing room with magazines to read, right? I mean, was she sort of treated as a cast member?
Yeah, I mean, we tried very hard, and the director did, which I appreciated, to make her as real as possible, that the crew could go on the same journey that we as the cast were being forced to go through. And, you know, she had a trailer, and she had her own, like, contract with nudity clauses and all the things that actresses would have. And you know, and I'll tell you, I've worked with actresses that have given me less. And she had... you know, she was given magazines in between takes, and you know, what was kind of amazing about the experience is by the end, people were trying it out. I saw you know, grips would take 5 minutes with their coffee and go over, and you'd see them kind of mumbling to her, trying to see what it was like to talk to her, and what she, the effect that she had was interesting. You just ended up getting into this, you know, dialogue with yourself, that was interesting, the dialogue to have. You know, I embraced it, and I started to see people embrace it, and you know, but ultimately, you know, the main criticism of the film that I heard was, you know, people saying, oh yeah, that's not possible, you know, people in the town would never believe she was real and would never go around acting like that, you know. And I mean, in one case I would say maybe that's not true, because I saw this film crew really try and give it a shot, but at the same time, you know, it was a fantasy. It's like a fairy tale.
Yeah,
you know,
a fable.
People were taking it so literally. It was interesting.
Well, Ryan Gosling, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Ryan Gosling spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Gosling's new film, Blue Valentine, opens in New York and L.A. December 31st. Coming up, our linguist Jeff Nunberg reveals his word of the year. This is Fresh Air. It's the time of year when everybody's coming out with their best of and top 10 lists, and linguists and dictionaries are eager to get in on the action. So we asked our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, if he could come up with his own word of the year. He thought about it and then said, no.
If you were ranking all those word of the year selections for importance against all the year-end best of and top 10 lists, they should fall somewhere between 10 biggest fashion faux pas and best celebrity tweets. They're either idle exercises or publicity gambits for dictionaries. And the short lists tend to run to the sorts of blends, malaprops, and stunt words that word geeks are drawn to, items like vuvuzela, webisode, and guidette. They're actually not even that interesting as words. They're the cat pictures of the English lexicon. So people were clearly misunderstanding the enterprise when they jumped on the new Oxford American Dictionary for designating Sarah Palin's repudiate as their word of the year. It wasn't meant to be an honor, and they weren't trying to vindicate Palin's usage, as commentators on both the left and right assumed. And I don't see that it matters whether the choice is actually a word, though if we are allowing non-words, I'd rather go with crotchel, as in crotchel area, the phrase some TSA people were using to delineate the perimeters of their enhanced pat-downs. It recalled nuancel, the creation of another pioneer of word formation, Alexander Haig, who died this year. Both words testified to a linguistic principle basic to the language of officialdom. If we can slap a Latin suffix on it, we can make it our own. But refudiate, guidette, vuvuzela, they don't have much to do with the general run of our conversation over the last 12 months. You could make a better case for some other recent words like crowdsourcing or double dip or Obamacare. But it struck me that you could also capture the prevailing mood by going to the other extreme and picking that common particle, no, in its various functions. Sometimes it signals absence or non-existence, and you can come up with a nice collage of the year's preoccupations by enumerating all the things that were in short supply. At one point or another, 2010 has been the year of no eggs, no fishing or swimming, at least in the Gulf, no campaign spending limits, and no ice at the North Pole. It's the year of no more narcissism, which will no longer be recognized as a diagnosis in the official psychiatric manual. It was the year of no hitters, It would have tied the modern record of 7 if the Tigers' Armando Galarraga hadn't been robbed of a perfect game when the umpire blew a call on the 27th batter. And let's not forget the year's most memorable declaration of existential insufficiency, that Texas skateboarder's, "Dude, you have no Koran." Closer to home, economists labeled 2010 the year of no inflation. That was good news for some, though for a lot of people, it was more notable as the year of no raises, no Social Security cost of living increases, no more home equity, or just no more home. Or in the case of Arizona Medicaid recipients, as the year of no more organ transplants. Now, I'll grant that you could cobble together a list of sentences like these to capture the zeitgeist of just about any year. After all, we're always running out of something. But this year's voids and shortfalls contributed to a mood that often expressed itself with another no, the one-word response that signals resistance or refusal. That word usually gets a bad rap in public life. It's never a compliment to call somebody a naysayer. So the Democrats obviously meant to put the Republicans on the defensive when they began to call them the party of no for opposing the stimulus bill in early 2009. As the New York Times' Ben Zimmer pointed out, that phrase has often been used by the party in power to label the opposition as obstructionist. Ronald Reagan branded the Democrats as the party of no in 1988, Bill Clinton did the same thing to the Republicans in 1994, and Tom DeLay turned the phrase back on the Democrats in 2005. What was different this time is that after some early defensiveness, a lot of Republicans embraced the label and even ratcheted it up a notch. "We're not just the party of no," Rush Limbaugh said. "We're the party of hell no." And Republican leaders quickly adopted the line. That extra word shifted the meaning of the phrase. It no longer suggested just opposition to particular bills and programs, but unapologetic and resolute defiance. That stance clearly resonated with a lot of voters. No has a great power to bring people together, precisely because it doesn't have to be pinned down. A child has a much harder time mastering yes, which is always the response to a specific prospect. "Do you need to go potty?" Whereas the child's first no comes earlier, as a pure eruption of willful refusal. And the word retains that capacity, even as we learn to intone it, to convey despair, anger, defiance, fear, astonishment, or disappointment. That's what makes these choruses of negativity so hard to read, whether they're unhappy voters or tired preschool kids in full shutdown. They're all sounding the same plaintive no, but it isn't as if there's any single juice flavor that will make them all happy again.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. You can find links to all of his commentaries from this year on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews some of the best new holiday pop music. This is Fresh Air. Every holiday season brings a new batch of holiday pop music, some of it from unlikely or obscure sources. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has been listening to all the new collection and has chosen a trio of albums that he thinks might make your holiday a bit more fun.
Every year I get ants in my pants when Christmas comes along. Every year I go into a dance, I know every single Christmas song. Every year I am first on the block to tell Santa what to bring. Every year I jump in with the flock, flying with the reindeer on the wing. I've got Christmas down pat, I know just where Christmas is at. You got your snow, you got your sleet, rain, and hail. I got Christmas by the tail.
That's Dan Hicks and the Hot Licks, applying his combination of blues, country, and jazzy swing to a new album called Crazy for Christmas. Hicks specializes in the mood most of us want to achieve around this time of year, a relaxed, chilled-out demeanor. Hicks is shameless in reworking his material. He turns his old song, Where's the Money, into the lowdown Christmas Morning, which finds Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer tossing back a couple of beers before leading Santa's sleigh. At the other end of that mood spectrum is Shelby Lynn's album Merry Christmas. the brooding country singer wouldn't have seemed a likely candidate for an album of holiday cheer. That's okay with me, since my favorite Christmas song has always been Elvis Presley's Blue Christmas. I like my holidays decked with melancholy. Listen to Christmas, a song Shelby Lynn has written, as a piece of kitchen sink realism set to a slow tempo soul melody.
Christmas makes me sad. Daddy's been bad. He made us wait on a tree. Bicycles for you and me. I want a radio, a ghetto blaster and stereo. Everybody's got one at school, and mama was nobody's fool.
Lynn is bold enough to offer a couple of the year's few new original songs. Along with covers of chestnuts like Silent Night and White Christmas, she provides this fine, upbeat composition called Ain't Nothing Like Christmas. Beginning with a simply strummed acoustic guitar and a bluesy vocal, it builds into the party song it wants to be.
Ain't nothing like Christmas, baby. Don't come but once a year. Ain't nothing like Christmas, baby. With carols and good cheer. Ain't nothing like Christmas, baby. Let's meet around the tree. I'll bring the nog you put on the log. It's a Christmas party. Oh, with tinsel in our hair and presents everywhere. Families in the kitchen watching it snow, yeah.
You can imagine Elvis rocking out to that one in his 1968 comeback leather outfit. Shelby Lynn's Merry Christmas is the most consistently good new holiday album I've heard this year. Another staple of the holiday genre is the anthology album that gathers cuts by a wide range of performers. Warner Brothers has put out the rather awkwardly titled Gift Wrap 2 Snowed In. It sounds like a discarded title for a Disney 3D animated film. The 21 selections on Snowed In include artists ranging from Devo to David Foster to the Flaming Lips. The sister duo of Tegan and Sarah have come up with a sly, sweet version of the Chipmunk Song. Yes, the 1958 novelty hit by Ross Bagdasarian. In this case, Tegan and Sarah have enlisted their mother to round out the act.
All right, Tegan and Sarah, ready to sing your song? Okay, Tegan.
Okay.
Okay, Ted.
Okay.
Okay, Sarah. Sarah. Sarah.
Christmas, Christmas time is near. Time for toys and time for cheer. We've been good, but we can last. Hurry Christmas, hurry fast. Want a plane that loops the loop. Meow wow, a hula hoop. We can hardly stand the wait. Please Christmas, don't delay.
The prettiest song on Snowed In is credited to Ben Keith, who died in July of this year. Keith is best known as a pedal steel guitarist working with Neil Young, and he enlisted Neil Young and Young's wife Peggy to sing a lovely version of Les Trois Cloches, or The Three Bells, the gorgeous pop hit for the brother-sister act The Browns in 1959. The song invokes Christmas in its first verse, but with its lyric about the cycles of a man's life, it's a bigger, more poignant piece of music, denying mere nostalgia.
There's a village hidden deep in the valley, among the pine trees half forlorn. And there on a Christmas morning, little Jimmy Brown was born. All the
chapel bells were ringing in the little valley town, and the song that they were singing was for baby Jimmy Brown. And the little congregation prayed for guidance from above. Lead us not into temptation, bless this hour of meditation, guide him with eternal love.
We use holiday music in different ways, most often as background sounds while we're doing something else. Novelty songs can be fun, but I never want to hear Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer again. The most interesting Christmas songs nod to, or even revel in, the loneliness that can surround the merry atmosphere. Whether you're seeking comfort, escape, or muzak, there's something for everyone in this new batch of holiday releases. As Devo sings on another song this season, Merry Something to You.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. You can hear three tracks from the albums he reviewed on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Whether you're Christian, Muslim, or Jew,
happy holidays!